Hi, I'm Rochelle Jackson. Welcome to the Crime Couch. I'm an investigative journalist and true crime author, and I know who's who in the zoo, the crims, the cops, and the interesting individuals in between. So get comfy and join me each week on the Crime Couch for a rollicking, intriguing tale. It'll be one heck of a journey. Graham Squirty Kent was in Victoria Police for 45 years. He joined as a 16-year-old cadet and had a varied career as a detective in the Armed Robbery Squad, Homicide Squad, Transit, Ethical Standards and the Police Association before finishing his career as a superintendent. In 2018, Graham was awarded an APM for exceptional service to policing. One case that stayed with him, and in fact Graham's still the VicPol spokesperson for, is the Hoddle Street Massacre. On the 9th of August in 1987, ex-Army cadet Julian Knight opened fire on innocent people in Hoddle Street, Clifton Hill. He murdered 7 people and injured 21. I'm sitting with Graham on the Crime Couch on a rather overcast and cloudy day in country Victoria. Hi, Graham. Thanks very much for returning to the Crime Couch.
Good afternoon, Rochelle, and happy to be back.
We're talking about the Hoddle Street Massacre, and you were responsible for assembling an investigating team. What were your initial challenges?
I was part of an investigation team led by a Detective Senior Sergeant Brian McCarthy. Brian at that time was a very experienced and highly regarded investigator coming towards the end of his career. Nonetheless, was a fantastic investigator. The challenges we had initially were to pull together a team because the scale of this was something that we'd never experienced before. Thinking back soon after the events and even looking at it now, I think we would take a very different approach and we would pull together almost a mini task force, at least for the initial stages, which is a little bit like what we did. We gathered a few people in from various places to help out. That challenge was not so difficult because there were plenty of willing participants. Another challenge was for the forensic examination of the scene, which was really important as it is in any investigation. And, of course, the scale of this across really a couple of suburbs and the events were across quite a considerable time was significant. And, of course, the just from a ballistics point of view, it was a huge challenge. But gee, they did a great job. They really applied themselves well. And remember, this was in the late 80s when we were not nearly as sophisticated or as we are now with in all those aspects. So other challenges were trying to, this is probably my first real experience of trying to manage the pressure that came from the media. It's not a criticism. There was, of course, there was a lot of significant, massive interest in the case and a lot of pressure. And a lot of pressure came directly into the office. People have contacts, Rochelle, can you believe that? And they make use of them. It also came down it also came down the chain of command, though. Again, that's not a criticism. Of course, we needed to be able to inform our managers about what was going on as early as we could, and for that matter, the community. So that was a new challenge for me I hadn't confronted before. I think we got through all that pretty well, and managed to compartmentalise what we needed to do. We sort of set that up pretty quickly, which was one of Brian's skills as an investigator and a manager. And another one was that Brian was very clear on what our job was here, and that was to remain professional, to remain objective and impartial, and gather the facts and put it together. And all the other stuff around the media and the emotional side of things in the community was stuff that we left for others to deal with.
Was there a lot of pressure from command and also from the government, state government, I'd imagine, and possibly federal government as well, to get results and get the brief done quickly?
Actually, no. I think that, and I think one of the reasons for that is that the responsible person was in custody and was clearly not going anywhere and was no longer a threat to anyone else. Mm. No, I didn't feel that sort of pressure. Obviously, there was a lot of interest. And I think that things did proceed in quite a timely way when you think about the normal timeframes. So no, that sort of pressure was more about later came some talk around the legislation around firearms. So there was a bit around explaining, did he have these guns legally or not? And he did. They were all legal. Mm. Legally purchased, he had a firearms license that provided for that. So there was a little bit around that, and I think, but again, we weren't, that didn't bother us too much. We weren't troubled by that. It fell to the government of the day to try and deal with that.
Did you interview Knight? And if so, what was he like? How would you describe him?
Brian McCarthy and myself interviewed Knight over. We did a couple of rather lengthy interviews, including the reenactments at the scene, one in darkness and one in daylight the following morning. What was he like? He was. It was really interesting when I think back. He essentially gave us quite a clinical debriefing of what he had done, which reflected, we think, his military background and his military training. It also reflected the clarity of mind that he had when he was doing what he did, and his recall was exceptional in terms of the detail he provided as to when he started shooting, who he shot at. He didn't know who they were, but vehicle, motorcycle, person on the road, police officer, helicopter, that sort of thing, and where he did it from. So, in fact, in the first or the second walkthrough that was recorded by video, he took us to the place where he had crouched and where he had shot at the helicopter and showed us the casings, which we may or may not have found otherwise. One of the things about doing a reenactment like that is you learn stuff that you may not otherwise get. So what was he like? He was, he was articulate. He was calm. He was a little bit reflective. When I say that, he came through as being really pleased with himself, with his marksmanship, his the way he handled the firearms, the way he kept cover. He was quite proud, I think, of the military skill that he was displaying.
Often with cases such as this, always there's an issue, and we've spoken about this before, about the prosecution has to ascertain whether or not this person had cognizance of what they were doing. And I suppose that you're looking at pleas of insanity, whether or not he was insane at the time. Were these some of the issues that you had to grapple with initially? Was he cognizant? Did he have clarity? It sounds like he did have complete cognizance of what he was doing.
Look, he absolutely knew what he was doing, no doubt, and very openly admitted that. He very openly admitted his intent in firing on these people was to kill them. That was his intent. He meant to kill, and he did. And that includes every shot he fired, he was intending to kill somebody. And, of course, that formed the basis of, I think it's something like 46 counts of attempted murder, to which he also pleaded guilty. So, we talked briefly about this in the last episode on the couch. Alan Bartholomew was brought in by Brian McCarthy to give us an assessment of his the guy's mental situation at the time of the offending. And that was really important for us because Bartholomew interviewed him within 12 hours of the offending, which is really unusual. It was a tremendous opportunity for us to try and understand. Although what it gave us was, here's a guy who is sane. He is not crazy. Even though you might think he is from a lay perspective to have done what he did, he was not. He absolutely knew what he was doing. He'd planned it, he'd thought about it, and he was able to recount it with absolute clarity and no disassociation whatsoever.
So did that make you reflect differently on him, knowing that he wasn't insane and that he was cognizant?
Well, you know, I personally didn't dwell on that a lot because our job was just to get the facts and get it how it was and for others to judge those things. We had in mind very early, which is why we got Alan Bartholomew in, that we needed to prove the case and we needed to prove what we needed to prove. We needed to be able to get the evidence. When I think about it now, though, I think, well, a narcissist, misogynist, incredibly selfish person who has gone on to demonstrate all of those characteristics throughout his time in prison as well.
So what sentence did Knight receive? Do you believe now that he did receive his fair whack?
He was sentenced in the Supreme Court by Justice Hample to life imprisonment with a minimum of 27 years to be served before he would be eligible for parole. Now, in those circumstances, anyone sentenced to life imprisonment, we need to provide a report on the case to stay with the Attorney General's Department and ultimately go to a parole board. And we did that, and we indicated in that report that the parole board of the day would need to look very carefully at his time in prison, his mental capacity, his development, his maturity, and be very careful about making an assessment before he's released. Now, ultimately, what happened was the Victorian government passed legislation which now means that he will only ever be released at a point in time when he is infirm. So he's essentially now under the legislation introduced by the government not long ago, he's essentially in prison for life. So for me, I think about sentencing this way as to say that that's not the police job. That's the job of the courts. I absolutely understand how people might see that sentence as wholly inadequate. I understand that. It's a matter of... I leave that to the courts, though. Our job is to catch the baddies and put them before the courts, and it's for the courts and the government to deal with it from then on.
Graham, since 2004, Knight's tried to bring more than 30 legal cases. He's tried to get access to a computer and even appealed to the United Nations at one stage for the crime scene and autopsy photographs, some of which he's managed to obtain. What do you think, what's his purpose and what's your views about what he's doing?
Well, what he's doing in the context of those sorts of things, I think, again, reflects the character of a narcissist, of someone who is, you know, there's elements of being a sociopath there. Now, there's a balance to be struck, of course, in terms of what his rights are. So the other bit is that we know this from a number of ways, is that he has spent a significant amount of time with prisoners, for example, such as Hugo Rich or Olaf Dietrich, well known in legal circles and in policing circles for being a jailhouse lawyer. And there's also another person whose name I won't mention because he's before the courts at the moment, with whom he spends a lot of time. Now, these people are litigants. They litigate for toilet paper. They litigate for pens, for computers. They litigate everything. And so he will have taken a lead from these people, no doubt. Dietrich in particular, well known for litigating in the courts and for causing as much disruption in the legal system as they can. And I think he's probably taken a lead and trying to ingratiate himself to those people. And you can read it in some of his material that it's worded up by them.
Does that frustrate you, I suppose, in lots of senses? You've put in an enormous effort to get the brief before the bench and then he's been given a sentence. Should the rights of the offender outweigh those of the victims?
I think they're really separate questions. I mean, we live in a system, and I think it's a really good one, where accused people have rights. Accused people must be afforded those rights, and prisoners have also got rights. And I'm very cautious about diminishing the rights of prisoners in the society we live in. I think it's quite separate from victims' rights, quite separate. And they're not related, in my view, and they should be treated separately. That said, I think it's been well recognised in the case of Knight, as it has with some other prisoners, that there's a limit to the extent to which the courts and government will put up with some of the things that they try and bring before the courts.
You must have gotten to know many of the police and some of the victims from the Hoddle Street massacre and this horrific crime. How are they coping? Do you know now, decades later?
Look, I really haven't been that close to any of the victims. I've had very minimal contact with them, to be frank. Something that I reflect on a bit and wonder whether I perhaps should have had more. Some of the police officers I've had quite a bit to do with. How are they coping? I know of police officers that simply have not coped very well. I think in some cases their career paths have been changed. They've not had the opportunity to realise their full potential because of the harm that they experienced. And I'm sure that is also so for some of the civilian victims.
What do you think are the learnings for Victoria Police about this incident? There'd be a lot of learnings, I'd imagine, across the board in a lot of police and the authorities. But what do you think were some of the learnings for Victoria Police in reflection?
We, I think, were a bit slow to learn from the experience of what took place back in August 1987. I will say, though, that we've come a long way. So this was the early days of the Special Operations Group. We now have other units that are really much better trained, much better equipped, and their operating model is much better than what we had back then. And I think some of that comes from the experience of Hoddle Street and other events around the world. The other thing that we're much better at now, although I still think we've got a long way to go, is how we care for victims and others who are affected by an event like this. For example, that small community of Clifton Hill, there was one police reservist who did a lot of work to try and help with the community, but it wasn't nearly enough. And of course, how we treat our own employees who are involved, not just the frontline police officers who are the first responders, but you know, even the public servants who might have been involved as forensic officers or otherwise involved. We do so much better, but we still got a long way to go to provide a safer workplace. In terms of prevention, I think that it took Victoria a long time, and it's still a problem in Australia, that is the level of violence that we have in the community, particularly with firearms. I've always hated guns. I understand sporting shooters and hunters, of course I do. There's a massive problem in Australia with guns still, though, that I think we should be doing more about. And, of course, it just blows my mind to think about what it's like in the United States, for example. So, you know, there's some of the learnings at a higher level that we were pretty slow, really, to hear and to act on.
What stays with you about this case, about the Hoddle Street massacre, Graham, today?
There's a couple of things. One is the extent of harm and how long lasting the harm is to people. And in that, I talk about some of the civilians who were injured and some who were there. and also the police officers. That stays with me, the level of harm. And one of the things that stays with me in that context is how different we all are and how we react differently to harm. It's that eggshell skull sort of analogy, where one person it can be harmed significantly and another person can sort of get through something without that level of harm. So that stays with me. It's been fascinating to learn about that. Sometimes I think about the child of one of the victims who was a toddler at the time, and I think, what on earth has that poor kid's life been like? I don't know. And the reason I think about that is that he was the same age as what my son was at the time. And I remember when I went and saw this little baby in the cot with his grandmother, and we had to get photographs of the glass, the little cuts that he had. I remember thinking, looking at him, thinking, what a gorgeous little kid, exactly the same as my boy. And I wonder what sort of life he might have had, and I don't know.
Well, see, that's the thing with trauma. It doesn't just stop with the initial person. It resonates right throughout the community and the family of these victims, as it would with the police families, no doubt.
Absolutely it does. You know, I know of some people whose operational policing career pretty much ended then. Some stayed on in other roles and some left Victoria Police. I know of others who have, continued on and had fantastic careers as well. So what's the impact on families? Who knows? I think that's one of the great unknowns. So when we talk about, seven people died and 21 people were injured, many, many more suffered significant mental trauma. And we don't ever fully know the extent of that.
And, of course, mental trauma doesn't just stop and start. If you've got PTSD or any stress-related anxiety, it stays with you for the rest of your life, doesn't it?
Well, I only know that from what I hear and what I read. I'm absolutely clear that is so, because I've seen examples of it in colleagues and even people that I'm not close to. So this is the sort of event that will create that sort of harm to people. And, as will any other violent crime. And so we need to do much more to reduce the level of violence. I think we're doing really well. We need to do more, and we need to do much more to understand the long-term impacts of this sort of event in terms of harm to people.
Finally, Graham, you're now out of the job. How do you reflect on this? Where do you put it? And, does it only come back when people such as myself come and ask you questions about it? Like, how does it stay with you, and how do you reflect on this now, this Hoddle Street massacre?
Well, it was at the time, it was the biggest thing that I'd been involved in. I'd been involved in some other quite substantial matters as well. And so I think about them all at different times. I spent 4 years investigating sexual assaults committed by police officers, an internal investigations task force. And I've got to say, that's some of the work I'm most proud of. And it's also some of the work that I reflect on more so, I think, because of what I saw in terms of harm. I don't think about it all the time. I mean, I've got a life outside Victoria Police now. What I think about, though, is what a fantastic community we live in Victoria, and how fortunate we are, notwithstanding, as I say, the level of violence and the other issues that we do have in Victoria. We are so fortunate to live in such a wonderful state, and I'm really grateful for my career and for the support I had of and the privilege I had, really, the real privilege of being able to serve the community of Victoria for the time that I did.
Well, Graham, it's been fascinating speaking to you today and last week, so thank you very much for sitting with me today on the Crime Couch.
Rochelle, thank you so much, and all the best to all your listeners.
Thanks for joining me. I'm Rochelle Jackson. and I look forward to your company next time on The Crime Catch.